Hello, and welcome to episode number 85 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. The year 2017 saw what appeared at the time to be a sea change in ufology when a key piece published in the New York Times made clear that the U.S. military had footage of aerial vehicles of unknown origin. In other words, not only were UFOs, now referred to as UAP, a thing, something those intimately familiar with the topic had long known to be the case, but the U.S. government, to some degree or another, was now publicly acknowledging this fact. Many within ufology assumed this was the turning point we'd all been waiting for, the historical event that would send this topic fully into hyperdrive, and not just in remote corners of the internet, but more importantly, within the mainstream. In the end, that wasn't what happened. The article made waves, to be sure, dragging the topic beyond X-Files land and tantalizingly closer to mainstream acceptance. Still, what many enthusiasts and researchers were left wondering was, why weren't these revelations enough to really bring us past the threshold into widespread conventional recognition of the validity of this topic? That question has lingered largely in a static status until this past week, when a new article by the same authors has brought to light startling allegations that take this topic well beyond the matter of strange lights in the sky. According to an article by Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal, a former intelligence official turned whistleblower named David Grush has alleged that elements of the U.S. military are in possession of intact and partially intact craft of non-human origin. And that is a quote. Because Grush has provided this information to Congress and the Intelligence Community Inspector General, filing a complaint alleging that he suffered illegal retaliation for his confidential disclosures, again a quote, and because officials have received these concerns as, quote, credible and urgent, unquote, once again we seem to be at the precipice of a word ufologists have been banting about for decades. Disclosure. True disclosure. Not hearsay, not rumors, but true widespread acknowledgement by government officials and widespread acceptance by the populace of the world that not only are we not alone in the universe, but the various beings who represent vast, sophisticated intelligence are here, in our very midst, and in a collective shock to the system, perhaps have been all along. As things stand right now, this is a dynamic situation, evolving daily as a story makes its way across the media landscape, inevitably landing anew in the awareness of untold numbers of the general public and on the desks of government officials all around the world. But where do things stand, really? Is there no turning back at this point? Have we crossed the proverbial event horizon? Is the end result, while still rolling out as we speak, already a foregone conclusion? Put simply, the question is this. Will these remarkable recent events finally catapult us into a new era in human civilization, where we recognize we are part of a cosmic neighborhood teeming with life forms we've as of yet been largely unaware of? And if so, what comes next? How will we be changed by these revelations? These are the very pressing and profound questions we'll seek to find some clarity around on this, the 85th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. Before we dive into recent events that make up today's episode, I just want to point out that for those of you interested in gaining access to all of my content, you can do so either by becoming a patron at patreon.com/exoacademian, or you can subscribe on Spotify. Both of those options will give you access to all content I create. That includes, of course, not only Point of Convergence and Liminal Frames, but also OTC Squared, which stands for Off the Cuff and On the Cusp, a podcast I record every month or so, as well as feature series that I create. Recently, I've done one on the raw material, and there's two episodes of that with more to come. So all of that is available to you if you become a Patreon patron or you subscribe on Spotify. All right, with that out of the way, let's dive into today's material. As I mentioned on social media recently, usually Point of Convergence is not a current affairs kind of show. But of course, we are not living in ordinary times. These are remarkable times to be living through, and how privileged are we to be living through them? First off, I'd like to say that for me, this is the culmination of something I knew was coming to some degree. I was aware of a behind-the-scenes plan to move this topic forward in a significant way in the public sphere, and I've been referring to that, at least partially, in social media and in podcasts over the last few months. So this marks a point where that really has come to fruition, although again, we still have a long way to go, and we'll get into that. But again, the key focus here is that the plan was to move this topic forward in a way that was ultimately unstoppable and irreversible. And so people behind the scenes have been working together, even internationally, to set up a situation where that would be the case, where we could, again, as I said in the introduction, catapult this subject into the mainstream in such a way that it really catches on and begins to be grappled with in a serious way by our civilization. Now, regarding these recent revelations, really the first shoe to drop was Christopher Mellon's article in Politico about a week ago saying that if you have crash retrievals, U.S. government, now is the time to come clean about it. That's, of course, a paraphrase. Following that up was a remarkable article that was published on Monday. This was Leslie and Ralph's article, Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal, outlining David Grush's claims. This was published in The Debrief. Now, I'll get into the fact that this article actually went through different publications before finally being picked up by The Debrief. We'll get to how that happened and what was behind that. The title of this groundbreaking article is Intelligence Officials Say U.S. Has Retrieved Craft of Non-Human Origin. Now, first of all, I want to point out that's key. They're not saying this might be non-prosaic. They're saying has retrieved craft of non-human origin. So that's a very specific claim. And that's key to what's going on here. For so long over the last few years, we've been dealing with naysayers who say this could just be next generation tech from China or Russia or what have you. One thing this article makes clear, based on what Grush has been privy to, is that a scientific objective analysis on the inside has determined that these craft are non-human in origin and fully non-prosaic. I want to read from the article now. Quote, a former intelligence official turned whistleblower has given Congress and the intelligence community inspector general extensive classified information about deeply covert programs that he says possess retrieved, intact, and partially intact craft of non-human origin. The information, he says, has been illegally withheld from Congress, and he filed a complaint alleging that he suffered illegal retaliation of his confidential disclosures reported here for the first time. Other intelligence officials, both active and retired, with knowledge of these programs through their work in various agencies, have independently provided similar, corroborating information both on and off the record. The whistleblower, David Charles Grush, 36, a decorated former combat officer in Afghanistan, is a veteran of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, and the National Reconnaissance Office, NRO. He served as the reconnaissance office's representative to the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force from 2019 to 2021. From late 2021 to July 2022, he was the NGA's co-lead for UAP analysis and its representative to the task force, unquote. And I just want to quote a couple other additional paragraphs. Quote, Grush said the recoveries of partial fragments through and up to intact vehicles have been made for decades through the present day by the government, its allies, and defense contractors. Analysis has determined that the objects retrieved are of exotic origin, non-human intelligence, whether extraterrestrial or unknown origin, based on the vehicle morphologies and material science testing and the possession of unique atomic arrangements and radiological signatures, he said. In filing his complaint, Grush is represented by a lawyer who served as the original Intelligence Community Inspector General, ICIG. We are not talking about prosaic origins or identities, Grush said, referencing information he provided Congress and the current ICIG. The material includes intact and partially intact vehicles, unquote. Now, again, I just want to point out here how groundbreaking this is, what is being claimed here. These allegations are startling. because not just is he pointing to there being craft that seem to be sophisticated, but he speaks to the specific analysis done on these craft. And again, quoting this one section, quote, analysis has determined that the objects retrieved are of exotic origin, non-human intelligence, whether extraterrestrial or unknown origin. Leaves that open. That's very important there. And then again, quote, based on the vehicle morphologies and material science testing and the possession of unique atomic arrangements and radiological signatures, he said, unquote. So again, we're talking about atomic kind of analysis of the material, of the metamaterial of these recovered craft. And they clearly point to this not being of human design, period. They're not going to say something as specific as that unless that really was determined. So this is groundbreaking in itself. It takes us beyond conjecture about this perhaps being next generation technology by China and Russia. And I've noticed that already, that in some of the discussion you're seeing online and in media in our culture at large, you're seeing less and less of that. Could this be China? Could this be Russia? Which is what we've heard many, many times in talking about the videos that came out in 2017 and whatnot, and other exotic objects that are observed in the sky. Because we're speaking here to a very specific and long-running reverse engineering program of craft of exotic origin, we can speak more specifically now to what these actually are, what they really consist of, and what this points to. And those details specifically are what is so groundbreaking about this article. Now, in a moment, I want to do a step-by-step re-representation of the timeline we've been in since this article came out. How have things moved forward in our collective culture? We'll get to that. But first, I want to just point out a couple additional things here. One, Leslie Kane, in discussions and interviews since the article came out, when confronted by skeptics who argue there's no way a program of this size could be kept secret so well for so long, Kane points out that the security cost for this program was more expensive than the program itself. Let's make that clear again. The cost for security alone was more expensive than the actual money that went into funding the program itself, the research, the re-engineering program itself. That says something to how top secret this was. Above top secret of almost anything else, any other program. We've long heard hints of this, but this speaks to this directly, how carefully guarded this was. And of course, we know many nefarious things happened by official sources trying to keep this secret for so long, not just discrediting people who had evidence, but also character assassination, sometimes even worse, even mortal danger for people who dared to speak about these things. This is what is part of the history. And as Ross Coulthard has pointed out on recent podcasts on Need to Know with Bryce Zabel, he believes this points to clear criminal behavior in the past, criminal behavior that should come to light in light of further investigations into this program because of the revelations that Grush has brought forward. I also want to point out that Grush makes the point that we've had a bit of a zero-sum game here internationally, that a new kind of Cold War has arisen around these materials, because let's make this clear, it's not just the United States that's recovered these materials. Again, I want to point to that we recovered not only crash material, debris and whatnot, but basically fully intact craft as well, which of course gives you a much better chance to try to reverse engineer it. We are not the only ones that have recovered these kinds of vehicles, this kind of material. It's happened around the world and continues to happen. Now, of course, one of the first things you'll hear from the naysayers in the mainstream is, why would spacecraft come all the way here from Zeta Reticuli or something like that, only to crash in the Earth's atmosphere? It sounds ridiculous. And so they're going to reject that. They're going to say there's no way these could be spacecraft. It doesn't add up. Those of us intimately familiar with this topic know there are some peculiarities like that. The public is now, for the first time, going to be going through the many-step process of trying to make sense of this peculiar and enigmatic topic the same way we within ufology have been doing over multiple years. And I'm going to speak more on that later on, because it says something about where we really are in terms of this becoming metabolized into our collective civilization and where we go from here. So again, Very interesting. Not only has there been recovered vehicles by the U.S., but other nations as well. And there's been this zero-sum game race towards being the first to really reverse engineer these craft because, again, because they are so sophisticated, it basically is game over for every other nation if you're the first one to arrive there, because this allows you to have basically geospatial and geopolitical dominance over the entire world. And yes, absolutely, along with you, I recognize that that is a sad state of affairs, although at the same time, you can also recognize how the U.S. military and allies would certainly want to get a hold of this before terrorist groups and things like that that could really use this to do real damage to our collective civilization. Nevertheless, it says something to the nature of our current situation where we still act against each other. And rather than uniting around this great mystery, the greatest mystery in the history of the world, in the history of our species, instead, we're still divided. We keep these things in the dark and we compete against each other. Now, speaking of what was going on behind the scenes as Kane and Blumenthal and others worked towards bringing Grush's stories to the surface, of course, Russ Coulthart is also interviewing Grush, and that will be available tomorrow, the full interview on News Nation. While there was this behind-the-scenes effort to bring this information forward, one thing became clear, and that is that the greatest chance this has for success lies in Grush's stellar reputation. His apparent credibility makes it difficult to bury this in vague innuendo and standard character assassination attempts, which is usually the modus operandi of the secret keepers who do their best to bury these things almost immediately. Now, to that point, recently, Susan Goh, spokesperson for the Pentagon, came out and said that Arrow has found no evidence to support these claims being made by David Grush. Now, of course, those familiar with the situation recognize that this misses the point altogether because part of Grush's allegations include the fact that Arrow does not have access to all the information. They don't have access to key elements of the information that would actually allow them to do their job. So for Goh to come out and say that Arrow has found no evidence of these allegations is like a bridge to nowhere. It's a nonsense kind of statement. Again, this points to the fact that we need media, journalists to come forward and ask hard questions, to not let the topic be dismissed so quickly, effortlessly almost, through clearly vague and ultimately misleading statements. And to that point, this last week, Matt Ford, host of the Good Trouble show, tweeted this, quote, "Members of the press, Pentagon spokeswoman Susan Goh will engage in a full-blown disinformation campaign to disparage Pentagon whistleblower David Grush in the coming days. She will distract you with DOPSR and Arrow and question his credibility," unquote. Again, my good friend Matt trying to give the heads up there to the media, to journalists, saying, look at what's happening here. Open your eyes. Begin to ask hard questions. Don't take these statements at face value, especially when they're so clearly misleading once you do even an iota of research. And again, let me make this clear here. There is an understanding amongst those who are trying to bring this information forward, even people on the inside trying to bring this information forward. This will not work if the media, if journalists do not do their job. The secret holders who want to get this out, and yes, those people do exist, will not be able to unless the public, the American public, holds feet to the fire, as the saying goes, demanding further investigation into these matters. And furthermore, we also need journalists fueling the public by doing their job and uncovering additional details and digging so that further revelations come to the surface. This is key if this is to work, this entire endeavor trying to move this forward and bring about what would be considered capital D disclosure. And as an aside, let me just add that not only do we need this for disclosure, but we need it for another D word, and that is democracy. We cannot have a sustainable functioning democracy if the press doesn't do its job. This is essential. And the truth is, we are in a sad state of affairs in terms of journalists really digging in and asking hard questions and not simply taking officials' comments at face value. Now, something else I'd like to point out here in terms of how this information came out. It's important to recognize that Grush was very careful and coordinated and strategic in terms of bringing this information forward and how he did it. First of all, I want to point out that he has a long history amongst different agencies in the U.S. government. He understands how the system works. He was a key player in drafting some of the whistleblower legislation that was arrived at last year. So again, think about this. He's being exposed to these revelations, but also knows that this information is highly classified. You cannot just bring this to the public, no matter how much you believe it is in the public's best interest. It would be illegal to do so. You would go to jail, etc. But the key here, and some detractors have seen this as a negative, and they actually use this to say there's nothing here, but a key point here is that he's not exposing classified documents. He's not bringing forward photos, videos, those kinds of things. He's talking about what he was told by people within the program. He speaks to the fact that even people he knew throughout his career actually had knowledge of this and later on began to tell him about this because of his work with the UAP task force. So he's bringing this forward in such a way that it allows for further digging, further investigation by Congress and whatnot without violating any of his NDAs and without actually bringing forth classified information specifically. But by doing this, it now allows other elements of government to do their job, we would hope, and dig further, begin to craft additional legislation if necessary to finally uproot and uncover the depth and full extent of these secrets. And by the way, I think one thing that will be shocking undoubtedly to the public is that the nature of those secrets make clear that this is about much more than space aliens, that in fact that might be a bit of a distraction from what's really going on, and the full complexity that this speaks to, points to, actually raising questions about the nature of reality itself. Now, we'll get to some of that later. Now, I want to go through a series of tweets that I made through the week as the information continued to roll out and as this gathered more traction in the mainstream. Now, one thing we should point out here, of course, is that there's one group of people that were largely left out of this conversation, and that is experiencers. And this often happens in these kinds of conversations at the public level anyway. We know that Arrow is very specifically not including experiencer testimony in their investigations. But we should take the opportunity to think about what experiencers are saying. How are the people who've been contacted by these various beings thinking about these matters? What kind of messages have been shared? Well, we know that historically, one clear message has been shared over and over again. It speaks to a coming cataclysm, a kind of apocalypse, if you will, because of the trajectory our civilization is on. I would suggest to you that these things are all connected. This is something I tweeted in this past week after these revelations came out. I said, quote, "In the midst of today's monumental disclosure news, I'll add one tidbit you perhaps haven't heard elsewhere. There has been a distinct uptick in messages provided by a contingent of the others, a contingent that sees what's coming. I would suggest to you that it's all connected," unquote. And then someone actually asked after I tweeted that, "Can you share the nature of the messages?" To which I replied, quote, "Generally speaking, the current trajectory of our civilization is not sustainable. We need a massive change in course. We need to transcend base capitalism and a commodity-focused view of the planet. Biosphere collapse awaits us, which they will inherit if we fail to change," unquote. And by the way, I'm also aware of messages to do with the craft that have been recovered and a potential threat they pose when used by us, when re-engineered by us, when we don't fully understand what we're dealing with. I'll get to that a little bit later in the episode. But I just want to point out again that we're kind of in a perfect storm in some ways, in the sense that not only are we receiving messages from these others speaking to our current trajectory not being sustainable, and that they actually have knowledge of. They're not just guessing. They're not just saying things don't look good from the way we see it, like you see it, from one point in linear time. They're saying they have awareness of the future. The way that they navigate space-time is different than us, much more sophisticated. Now, when we look around at what we see arising right now, we have this perfect storm brewing. We have nuclear arrangements that are happening right now, resorting and reposturing of geopolitical forces. We have China, Russia, the U.S., allies, all reposturing around nuclear arms. We also know that, as Warren Buffett recently pointed out, the challenge with nuclear weapons is once you create them, you can't uncreate them. And almost as a certainty, as time goes on, more and more nation states and even potentially terrorist groups will get their hands on nuclear weapons. Just think about how dangerous that is, what we're sitting on right now, and how it will only become more dangerous as time goes on. In addition to that, we have bioweapons, and this recent pandemic points to what that can do. We also have the arrival of artificial intelligence. We're close to general artificial intelligence. And again, with our current level of consciousness being not very high, the threats that that poses to us, again, because we treat that like a zero-sum game too. We don't think about what would be in the greatest good for the greatest numbers of people. Instead, we compete with each other. We race to this conclusion. And because of the current center of gravity in terms of collective consciousness, we face the possibility that AI will get out of control, that we will cede our own demise in this race. By the way, that's also a message I've heard some people receive from some contingents of the others. Something to keep in mind. And again, I just want to add in this one last piece, that the retrieval and attempted reverse engineering of these craft themselves also poses a kind of threat. And what happens now as this becomes more and more public? That's also a question to think about. How are all of these different elements, these points of convergence, if you will, pointing to some kind of culmination point? And how is that related to the fact that we're seeing more and more interaction, intervention of these others? Why are our naval groups seeing so much activity when compared with history? Why are people receiving so many telepathic messages from different groups of these others? This is what's in the public discourse. Some people, again, are only aware of some of these parts. The nuts and bolts people tend to only think about one aspect of the data. Perhaps experiencers only think about messages. You have to really, I think, consider all of this and ask questions about what this might be pointing towards in terms, again, of this culmination point, where it seems like everything is leading towards one key event. And of course, that raises the question, is that key event that all of these converging forces are leading us towards the very event these others are warning about, telling us about? How will our collective response to these revelations brought forward by Grush and others change our trajectory as a civilization? Or how will the lack of response be ultimately what seals our fate? Again, as I've said on recent podcasts, we are aware of the questions. We are aware of the messages that have been brought forward. The question is, what will we do with this? And it's not just us within ufology now. As more and more of this becomes metabolized in the mainstream, we as a civilization will have questions to answer. And those questions will be arising with this new data at the very time that we are facing civilization-ending, potentially, challenges. How will this all work together? This, I think, is the key question. But now let's get back to events as they rolled out this week. I want to reflect again on tweets that I made as the days went on. One of the things I said the next day after the publication of this article by Keen and Blumenthal was, quote, "As hoped for and expected, a piece that started in a relatively new and not widely read publication is being picked up in much more mainstream publications," unquote. I followed that up with another quote, "The web of coverage continues to grow, now Fox News, NBC, ABC, CBS, New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, etc., when are you going to publish the civilization-changing news?" Unquote. And then, of course, other papers internationally also picked this up, The Guardian being one of the first key ones to do so. But this brings me to something I mentioned earlier. What was the series of events that led to this article being published in a publication like The Debrief, which, while respected, is relatively small and new? The reason that happened is because other major papers turned this article down, which again, I think says something about the nature of media and journalism in America today. The New York Times passed on an early draft of this article, which again speaks to how differently the New York Times and its editorial board handles these kinds of pieces now as opposed to 2017 when Blumenthal and Kane published the groundbreaking article that kicked this all off, the most modern UFO era, you could suggest. Again, there's been a turnover of some of the editorial members since that time, and clearly they are not nearly as open to publishing these kinds of pieces as they used to be. The Washington Post also had a chance to publish this. In fact, they were one of the last ones that was considering doing so, but they were trying to get confirmation from official members of Congress and whatnot to try to corroborate some of this. And because that was delaying things and taking much longer than Kane and Blumenthal were comfortable with, they eventually went with the debrief. Politico and The Hill were another two outlets that turned this down along the way. So again, they tried to get this published in the most well-recognized publications and outlets, but ran into problems in doing so. Ultimately, as Kane has pointed out since then, part of the reasoning for going ahead and publishing when they did, rather than waiting for the Washington Post to perhaps finish their vetting and whatnot and their confirmation and their additional sourcing, what was determined was that Grush himself was potentially in danger because his name had been leaked online. He was already receiving threats. Again, whistleblowers are taking a huge risk, even one as calculating and as intelligent as Grush. He recognizes he was in danger, not just politically, not just professionally, but also in terms of danger to his very life. We know what secret keepers have done historically, allegedly, including ending people's lives who tried to bring this information forward. Certainly, he could have been in danger, and Kane and Blumenthal didn't want to take that risk. So that's why they decided to go ahead with the debrief when they did. Now, earlier on, I pointed out that one of the reasons Grush came forward is because he recognized that Arrow, the body that was created to try to look into this, didn't really have sufficient access to actually do their job. But there's something more than that that kind of comes up here that we should consider, and it's quite troubling, really. And it has to do with the fact that not only perhaps does Arrow not have sufficient access to the kinds of information that would allow them to answer the questions they're supposed to be investigating, but in addition, is it possible that Arrow has been set up with the intention to never come to the real truth here? Again, we have people like Moultrie who've appointed Kirkpatrick, and we have previous whistleblowers like Luis Elizondo who resigned in protest from his position because he recognized there wasn't really this commitment to truth and bringing this to the public. Elizondo has said that Moultrie was one of the people that was actually a roadblock in the process historically. That was his experience. So again, we have to ask questions when he's in charge in putting Kirkpatrick in his position. And even then, there's been questions raised around whether Kirkpatrick even has the kind of clearances that would allow him to really get to the relevant information. And then furthermore, we have news recently that Arrow also paid for perception management, quote unquote, to an outside private company. Now, this raises questions to which I asked on social media, quote, why is Arrow, which is supposed to be about impartial, objective, methodical, science-based investigation with a supposed commitment to public transparency, spending millions for perception management, unquote. Now, again, there are some who would say this just goes with the territory. Whenever you have an agency like this who's investigating these kinds of things, perception management is just part of the task. Otherwise, you will have chaos. But in light of some of these other revelations and these other questions that are at least being posed and the history that we're aware of here, at the very least, begs certain questions. Now, since the original article came out last Monday, you may have noticed that Leslie Kane, in various interviews, has sort of distanced herself from these questions or these concerns or these statements made about bodies recovered. And in clips from the interview with Ross Coulthart, it's clear that Grush makes clear that yes, indeed, recovered bodies of non-human origin have been part of this enterprise. He points out that when you recovered crashed vehicles, you quite often recover dead pilots. That's basically the claim here. This will be talked about more in the interview that will happen on Sunday between Ross Coulthart and David Grush. But the reason Leslie Kane is distancing herself from those aspects is, number one, because it was not part of the original article, so that's a truthful statement. But I would also suggest to you it's because Kane is calculating what will actually be palatable to the public and what will not be. So we go from lights in the sky to the idea of them being technologically advanced, sophisticated, craft of some sort. And then once we get past the idea that perhaps it's the Chinese or the Russians who just leapfrogged us in terms of technological advancement, we get to the possibility that these are not conventionally human whatsoever, which of course gets us to the doorway of the question around, okay, if these are not of human origin, then who exactly is operating these vehicles? But the reason why I think Kane is careful to distance herself from that claim at this point relates to a tweet that I also published last week. And it goes as follows, quote, "Part of the trickiness of rolling out details uncovered by David Grush include calculating the difference between the full extent of the revelations and what the American public and mainstream media can metabolize at any given time. These two are not at all always in alignment. And to be clear, the end goal is to make this story go fully viral, catching fire amongst the mainstream so as to make its momentum unstoppable and irreversible." Unquote. Now, following this initial tweet, someone responded to me saying, "Sometimes the responsibility to the truth is more important than predicting the effect it will have on others." True, but then I followed up with this. Quote, "To be clear, I'm not even saying this is about that. I'm saying the story can die prematurely if it isn't digestible to various gatekeepers along the way. That's the tricky game that's being strategized as we speak in terms of what is and what isn't included." Unquote. And this speaks basically to the strange situation we find ourselves in. It's not truth that ultimately wins out here. It's what's digestible by the masses. It can be true, but if it's a bridge too far, it will die on the vine, as they say. So there's a calculation being made here by the people trying to bring this information forward that it's done in such a way that it grounds itself, it's metabolized by the public, by the mainstream, to enough of a degree that further revelations can take it further. But there's this recognition that it has to be done in a certain way for this really to have the reach and the impact that it potentially has. Now, again, when we speak about what's actually palatable to the masses versus what is really in the mix here, to those of us intimately familiar with this topic, you can quickly see that all that's really being talked about in the mainstream is this human or is it extraterrestrial? Now, interestingly, Grush has actually brought forth other possibilities. He didn't just leave it to those two. He said it could be something else. He pointed to his background as a physicist and the possibility of other dimensions. So he's speaking there to the interdimensional kind of possibility as well. But this again speaks to where we're at in the public conversation. I just want to remind us all that some of the things that took us years to come to, some of the notions that we came to only by a step-by-step process, that process is just beginning. In fact, we're not even clear yet that it's been fully metabolized to the point where this will be a thing. This will be an aspect of public knowledge moving forward that's been clearly acknowledged and is being acted upon in terms of further investigation and further contemplation of the implications. But this speaks to another tweet that I made this week. As these things continued to roll out and as more and more networks and papers around the world began to pick up on the story, I said, quote, "When it comes to the metabolizing of these revelations by the mainstream, one of, if not the most challenging aspects will be that, as Vallée and Hynek determined decades ago, the ETH, that is the extraterrestrial hypothesis, is likely far too simple an explanation for the complexity of the data at hand." Unquote. Now, I'd like to comment here that some people followed up this tweet by saying things like, yes, indeed, the extraterrestrial hypothesis might only account for one aspect of the phenomenon. There may be other origin sources in the mix as well. And that's certainly true. But I'd also like to point out what I think Vallée and Hynek were really getting at here. It's not just that it's incomplete in terms of there could be other origin sources as well, but they were actually pointing to the fact that our understanding of space-time is so insufficient, perhaps even woefully misguided, to the point where these are not really space aliens at all, or if they are, that's only one small aspect of it, based on a notion of space-time as a foundational model of reality that is frankly just basically barking up the wrong tree. Again, we have physicists these days like Nima Arkani-Hamed saying this is what we already know. Space-time is not foundational. There are deeper structures. The math is already telling us this. So again, we have alignment here between modern physics and scientific revelations and what we see evidenced in this historical data. But again, this is something that the public is just beginning to reckon with. And the point is, if we try to push too much too soon, it may die on the vine before it's really grounded into our society in such a way that we can be sure of further investigation. Now, speaking to this notion of other hypotheses that perhaps are more apt than the extraterrestrial hypothesis, one, of course, involves Michael Masters' notion of them being extratempestrials, that is, beings that are from the future as we understand it, and not only beings from the future, but beings who are our direct descendants. Now, again, this is key here, and this relates to something I said earlier. First of all, I want to point out that this has been rumored for some time, this DNA link, even the possibility, as I've said on recent podcasts, that the bodies recovered at Roswell and other places were shockingly found to have some sort of genetic connection to us. That raises additional questions around what is the nature of that connection. But let's take for a second the notion that they can move through time and they are somehow related to us, and perhaps even somehow connected to the Earth directly in terms of their ancestry and their ultimate origin, even if in the future, in their further sophistication, they've explored the cosmos. But are they really extraterrestrial in that sense? Is that the best way to describe them? Probably not. Nevertheless, this raises other interesting questions and possibilities. Even when we think about historically controversial notions like MILABS, that is, military alien involvement. Now, part of the challenge here is that it's very difficult to find evidence of this kind of cooperation between U.S. military, for instance, and alien groups. Some would argue that there isn't enough evidence to substantiate people's claims of coming into contact with these kinds of arrangements where they see both what seem to be Earth humans as well as aliens. But again, if we bring time into the mix, and if the human genome changes over time, is played with, spliced with other different kinds of beings, perhaps even from the Earth. Again, we think about the mantids and the greys and these kind of insectoid forms that also we see present on the Earth. Then perhaps the timepiece begins to make sense of a lot of this. And of course, this is what I've been talking a lot about recently. I don't want to leap to the conclusion. I don't want to land at the conclusion that these are us from the future, full stop. But I think there is evidence that they're somehow connected to us, which raises questions about their origin and their connection to Earth. And it also, I think, speaks to how we don't really understand space-time. We already know this, but again, what we see with them is an ability to move through time, seemingly effortlessly. I also want to point out, earlier we talked about experiencers. Experiencers are very often told that they are us and we are them. These are direct quotes, basically. And they also mention being so far from the future that we wouldn't even really understand it. And when you think about that, you also recognize that as time goes on and we understand more and more of reality, our models of reality evolve and sometimes completely reinvent themselves with new data, then it's not surprising that their understanding would be so far above ours, even if they are ultimately connected to us and perhaps our descendants, that it would be something that we couldn't really grapple with and fully understand yet because we're just working at such a primitive understanding compared to where they are. And of course, perhaps more importantly, when they are relative to us. Now, speaking of when they are relative to us and how they got here, I just want to raise something else that is potentially concerning, something else that relates to messages some experiencers have received from a contingent of these others. And it has to do with these vehicles, the nature of these vehicles, and what they're capable of doing. Again, according to what we just discussed with them being extratempestrials potentially, there's the issue, of course, of them traveling through time, that these are time travel vehicles, not just vehicles that allow us to move through space. And so part of the messaging has revolved around the fact that these are very dangerous vehicles when you don't know what you're doing, that both the past, present, and future, as we perceive and understand them and experience them, can be directly impacted if these vehicles are used incorrectly. And again, I want to remind you of the fact that as different nation states rush to understand these things first, how careful are we being? and what might we be creating in terms of a consequence, an implication that could affect all of us in that race for technological advancement, still based around a zero-sum game of nation states competing with each other. Now, as we draw to a close for this week's episode, I'd like to point out a few things that I think we should be aware of. One has to do with us becoming accustomed to the kinds of conversations that are had in the public that will feel painfully slow and first level to those of us intimately familiar with this topic. And this relates to something I tweeted just today. I said, quote, "Making some sense of the peculiarities around the UFO phenomenon involve a multi-step process. One has to metabolize landing at level one before inevitably becoming aware of level two, and on it goes. Binary thinking is the doom of progress here. A challenge that will arise for many of us in ufology is that as these revelations spread into the mainstream, various new quote-unquote experts will emerge, jumping straight to binary thinking or quickly landing at level one of the multi-step process I just referenced, and then confidently declaring the matter done. All that is to say, be ready for a long ride. It only gets more complex from here as this serum spreads further into the body public," unquote. Now, that tweet was in reference to how much the public has to evolve to really begin to grapple with this topic. But I would point out that even those of us within the conversation, within ufology, as it's called, still are not grappling with the full scope of what this points to. And so I leave you with this final concluding thought. When it comes to debating different hypotheses to explain the enigma colloquially referred to as the UFO phenomenon, it's apparent that many, even within the ufological community, are not yet seeing just how deep the rabbit hole goes. The issue is not really about what percentage of apparently non-human beings are extraterrestrial versus interdimensional, etc., but rather just how incomplete or even woefully misguided is our very understanding of reality altogether. It's from our fundamental understanding of all that is that we generate hypotheses to begin with, and I contend that the update we need to undergo will have to happen on that foundational level, that will need to happen before we can move on to step two, generating meaningful and testable hypotheses. To that end, I would suggest to you that we must be ready and willing to unlearn, or at the very least fundamentally recontextualize, much of what we've long assumed to be what I've called the myth of close to pinnacle knowledge, rooted in the arrogant belief that we're close to understanding all that is, long before we can really arrive at anything close to what one might consider sufficient understanding from which to make sense of the dizzying array of complexity the UFO phenomenon and general paranormality presents to us. Without doubt, we are in a new era, and what a time to be alive. But let's not make the mistake so many of our ancestors have made, assuming that this new dawn represents the summit of understanding. What it represents is a new plateau with exciting virgin terrain to be explored and mapped. But let us remember that that exploration itself will lead, inevitably, to our next level of understanding and potentially to our next stage of collective consciousness. And so it is, and may it be so. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.